It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me. Have to teach the children about living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching us close, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, October 6, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola. This radio program does not have any corporate sponsors. Therefore, we are free to discuss controversial topics that you might not hear about on other programs. My website is spingola.com. There you will find information about my books, The Ruling Elite series, as well as a timeline of book 2 and 3, which is, of course, a work in progress. Please also visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains the website, spingolaspeaks.wordpress.com. All of the more recent audio files of my programs are at that site, including the RBN Archives, the American Free Press Archives, and the archives of this program. My new Twitter account is twitter.com/Deanna Spingola. Our guest today is Mike King. We will be taking questions. Let me just bring him on. I see he has just called in, which I'm very happy that he has called in. Anyway, as I was saying, we will be taking questions at 646-787-1915. And, of course, we invite you to visit the chat room at spingola.chatango.com. If you wish to ask questions or make comments via my email, you may do that at comment@spingola.com. My guest today is Mike King. He is the author of New World Order, Forbidden History, 1763 to 2013, and the author of many, many wonderful, wonderful articles. The website is tomatobubble.com, and I'm not sure what happened to our intro music. I clicked the button, and nothing happened. Anyway, so we didn't have intro music. I'll just make certain that we have outgo music. Okay, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hello, Deanna. Good to be with you. It's been a long time.
It has. Yes, the last time you were with me, I think we talked about Roosevelt. FDR.
Yeah. I think it was last Christmas. Yeah, I had written a piece on FDR, American Tyrant.
Yes.
Since that time, there's been so many other productions at Tomato Bubble.
Indeed. And I get your updates all the time, so I am aware of what you're talking about. Yeah, we talked on December 23rd. Which is when we talked about a lot of stuff. And I think that you were also on my American Free Press program. But anyway, this is yet another new network. I seem to be bouncing around here. But anyway, I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, lots to talk about. So much has happened in the last year. I'm going to have to update NWO Forbidden History to 2014. That's for sure.
Oh my gosh! Some of the stuff that's going on, it's just amazing. Things.
It
seems
like they opened up the floodgates on us. You know, hitting us with something new every week.
Yeah, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Okay, where do you want to start? I've got your website open here, and as I mentioned, I do get your updates, and I hope that people will sign up to get your updates. You just recently you put out something that's really kind of funny. You said, "Meet the white boys and the redheads of ISIS." And I looked at that photo and I thought, yep, he's got a point there. These Arabs could use some sunblock.
Evidently, somebody went off the script and took off their ski mask. You know, it gets, excuse me, it gets hot out there in the desert. So from time to time, these ISIS terrorists have to remove their ski masks, I suppose.
Yeah.
And you see the picture that I posted there, that I just stumbled upon briefly on Yahoo, actually, is a gentleman with red hair, as red as any Irishman, and pasty white skin, and there he is, Arab terrorist.
Yeah. So, and red hair, long red beard, and then you also, just beneath that, you show all of these vehicles. And you wonder, well, where did all of these look-alike vehicles come from? Everything seems to be very color coordinated. As a person who's dealt with a lot of color in other areas, I note that color right away. I mean, it's all and of course you have too. What a lot of nice vehicles they have.
They've got quite a well-funded, well-organized organization, this ISIS does, which, you know, we're to believe sprouted up overnight right under the nose of the CIA and the Mossad and the various Arab government intelligence agencies and, of course, the NSA. I mean, you go back to June 17th when the story broke. I mean, nobody had heard of ISIS or anything like it. Then on June 18th, all of a sudden, there it is on the front page of the New York Times. It just took everyone by surprise. Of course, you know, it's impossible to build a fighting force of, 20, 30,000 thugs, well-armed with machine guns, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, brand-new, spanking-new pickup trucks with truck-mounted machine guns, uniforms, flags. I mean, this just materialized overnight, and nobody knew about it, of course.
Indeed.
But ISIS is fake, and I like to refer to it. Well, it's interesting, Diana. As a joke, I started referring to it as Israeli secret intelligence services.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
lo and behold, somebody came up with a video from the 1990s. It was a gentleman on C-SPAN. I don't know if he was former CIA or written a book, but he said right on there, he says, within the agency, we refer to Mossad as ISIS, Israeli Secret Intelligence Services. They use acronyms so they don't have to say the word.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's right in your face. You know, this is definitely the axis of evil at work. You know, usual suspects, CIA, Saudis, British, and, of course, the Mossad, creating this fictitious boogeyman. Whose sole purpose is to drag us into the area, into war.
Sure. And what about the beheadings?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, these things are so transparently fake. You know, I've seen stuff when I was a kid. I used to go to these, haunted horror houses down the Jersey Shore. They do a better job at blood and gore and decapitating theatrically than this ISIS bunch does. But, you know, you review every one of these so-called beheading videos,
mm-hmm.
and they always stop at the moment that the jugular is about to be severed. And these are the terrorists themselves. So I wonder if these terrorists are thinking to themselves, well, we don't want to put too much blood on here. Children might be watching. We'll kill people, but, you know, we want to be respectable about it. I mean, they're censoring their own videos, but you never see an actual jugular vein being severed. You just see someone in an orange jumpsuit, which is odd because that's, you know, U.S. standard issue. Why are all these prisoners wearing orange jumpsuits?
They may as well have USA on them or some sort of an emblem.
Yeah, and then we come to find out that the first so-called victim, James Foley,
mm-hmm.
he was also kidnapped. He was kidnapped in 2011 during our overthrow of Gaddafi. And they made a whole call celeb out of that. There was a website, freefoley.org, and they had all this artwork and yellow ribbons, and they interviewed his parents. It was that whole, you know, wag the dog scenario. And then they ended it as soon as Gaddafi was overthrown. And this is the same journalist. Now he's kidnapped again in Syria. How convenient.
Yeah, he's got a real problem being kidnapped.
Yeah. They trot out his fake family members on TV. They're interviewed by Katie Couric. The grieving sister can't stop giggling. It's just incredible.
Right.
They have such contempt for the intelligence of the public that they don't even try to be realistic. They put more effort into Hollywood B-movies than they do into these silly videos, and the public buys it.
And what are they doing stopping to make a video? Seriously.
I'm sorry?
Why would a group like this just say, oh, hey, let's make a video of this, and then set up cameras and all this other stuff? People don't do terrorists wouldn't do that. So-called terrorists are not going to do that.
So absurd. And you hear the the scripts from the video where they directly address Obama. It's like, Obama, we will kill this infidel. What are you going to do about it? It's inducing him, pushing him to go there. Now, think about it. You're this so-called terrorist group. You've got your hands full fighting the Iraqi regular armed forces, fighting the Syrian military, fighting the armed Kurds. What kind of strategy is this to induce the greatest superpower in the world to come and get you?
Right.
How ridiculous. Why would they do that? So clearly what the Zionists want is to drag us in there and embroil us into this phony, fictitious battle against ISIS. I mean, there's stories out in the mainstream media that we've been bombing a bunch of empty buildings and fields, and people have gotten advance notice. So it's a sham fight. But sooner or later, I know what they're going to try to do is redirect this U.S. effort into overthrowing Assad. So we're back to square one where we were about 1 year ago.
Sure. And when people who are taken with all of these beheading stories, I say, well, we went into the Middle East, we've killed millions of people, displaced millions more, and you're going to complain because they cut off four or five heads? I think that, you know, we shouldn't have been there. These people shouldn't be over there.
Yeah.
And that's for the people who fall for these Hollywood tactics, these antics that they're trying to pull.
Yeah. Well, this is when you're consumed with arrogance, like our modern society is, you can never even contemplate what it is that you might be doing wrong to upset other people. It's always the other guy's fault.
Right.
Never the USA.
And the other thing, and you've already made mention of this, when you scroll down on the page, honestly, I mean it's so obvious. When something is pointed out to you, it becomes very obvious. When maybe before you think, but exactly what are all these people running around in the desert in black clothes with hoods and their face covered? I mean, seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
and they're wearing gloves and white tennis shoes.
That's right.
Did they get these nice Nikes or whatever they are?
Yeah. Well, the gloves and the mask are, I mean, one, I suppose, if one wants to twist the argument, they could say, well, they wear the mask so their face can't be identified. Okay, well, why the gloves?
Exactly.
But conceal the lily white skin of these Mossad and CIA agents. There are Arab fighters amongst their ranks. Those are the dupes, the criminals, the mercenaries who really don't know what the big picture is. But a lot of these guys, and they've been caught, just like that gentleman with the red hair that I posted.
Yeah, that's so funny.
So that's why they wear the gloves, because, you know, you see some pictures where there's not gloves, or if you see a little space between the wrist and the end of the arm, you just see a vastly disproportionate amount of very white-skinned Arab terrorists. I mean, you know, once in a while you might get one, but these are straight-up Caucasians. And, of course, the gentleman with the red hair also has that classical Semitic, Khazar nose, too.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed that right away. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, what else have you been writing about? You have written, just scrolling down your page, recent updates, and I hope that people will look at some of the things that you have on your website. I mean, they're just terrific things that you've written. You've talked about the Bad War. You've talked about Hitler versus the New World Order. Get your PhD in New World Order Studies. And, of course,
my most recent book, I mean, as far as the illustrated articles, there's probably about 3 to 4 new ones a week that are posted. And most of the content is free, but there are also paid PDFs and books. My most recent actual book, which just came out a few months ago, was The God of Logic, A Deductive Debunking of Unscientific Atheism.
I want to talk about that.
Yeah. So, well, that's the book that's on sale now. It's also at Amazon. This one, I mean, with my previous works, they've been done at a copier and bound with plastic comb binding. This one's professionally done. I had it done through Amazon's CreateSpace service, and it's even got an ISBN number. People can pick it up at the website, or they can go to Amazon.com and look for The God of Logic.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Did you have, was that easy to do through Amazon? Because I get people ask me all the time, how do you publish a book? How did you do your books? And I've never worked with Amazon, but has it been a good experience for you, for those other people who might be looking for a way to publish their work?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. They kind of suck you in with, well, it's free. And then they have cover templates that you could design. But then their cover templates are so basic and structured and really lacking in form, you really don't want to use it. So if you want a decent cover with your own image, it's going to cost you about $400.
Okay.
But
that's
all,
not too bad.
All, it's very simple. No, it's not. It's very simple. You just, you know, once you've got your Word doc completed or your PDF, you just submit it. And then they format it for you. You can expect, you know, 3 to 4 weeks. And then, you know, they put it on Amazon for you. I mean, they do everything for you. All the author has to do is promote it.
Wow, that's good.
So, yeah, well, this came out really nice. And I hired an artist, professional illustrator, to do the cover,
which is very nice looking, I think.
Yeah, it's very very whimsical. There's an image there, you know, God is up there waving from the clouds down at an observatory, and we have all these atheists running out of the observatory in fear. There's a picture of Stalin and Karl Marx and the devil and Charles Darwin. So, but I think
I like that
very
little
useful.
Fish.
Yeah, the little fish with the legs. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not a heavy scientific book at all, because that's really not my background. I mean, I just dabble in it. But it's just a logic-based refutation of atheistic evolutionism / Darwinism that really anyone should be able to understand and look at this theory and say, wait a minute, how is this possible? There's just so much about the theory that you know, it's one of those things that's like shoved down your throat, and you're told, you're not educated unless you see this. Sort of like
sure.
The Emperor's New Clothes syndrome. But when you really get into it, I found it quite easy to dissect the arguments, which are ludicrous to say the least. And then I also go into the political forces that pushed it. And one of the things I discovered in my research, I mean, I always knew that the communists and the Marxists were, you know, big into evolution, but I didn't realize the extent of it from the very beginning. Frederick Engels was one of the first to receive, he received one of the original copies of Darwin's Origin of Species, and then he showed it to Karl Marx. And Karl Marx's closest associates themselves reveal how obsessed they were with the theory. That's all that they could talk about, because they saw great use in it to destroy any belief in a creator. But they were heavily, the international left pushed this thing hard. So there's a political component that ties into the New World Order and all of that.
Sure.
But the book's very humorous. It's very easy to understand. Even in the areas where I dabble into scientific matters, I keep it so basic. Like, for example, I talk about like DNA and how even the simplest cell, being an amoeba, has millions of lines of DNA code that are like computer code. So this whole idea of a simple cell coming out of nothing and then in time becoming more complex is ludicrous, because there is no such thing as a simple cell. There never was. Within every cell is in essence a computer chip. So to say that first simple cell evolved out of primordial ooze spontaneously is like saying that a computer chip just came into existence without any design or spontaneously.
Sure.
So that's the way I present, you know, when I do touch upon scientific matters. So this is for everybody, and it's ideal for kids, high school kids, because that's when they really start shoving the atheism and the evolution down their throats hard. And I maintain anybody who reads this cannot possibly believe in Darwinism.
Exactly. I do have a couple of programs that I watch on TV. And one of the ones that I watch, it's ridiculous, but it takes place in Chicago. And I just started watching it. It's called The Good Wife. And since I live in the Chicago suburbs, and it deals with lawyers and law, and it's very similar to the politics that go on in Chicago. And
yeah.
Oh my gosh, that program pushes atheism just absolutely to the hilt. Absolutely. And I'm not going to watch this anymore. And there's so much atheism pushed, well, even in the so-called alternative media. And it's kind of disturbing to me. Now, I am against corporate church, a corporate church that you know, signs up so that they can get their 501(c) status, so that they can, well, they're really another corporation that is attached to the key corporation, which is the United States government, and
sure.
They are just one of the you know, that's the mother corporation. And so, but I do believe in Christianity. I do believe that it is our value system. And anybody that really thinks that people just appeared, as you say, out of the ooze, when you just look at the human body itself and the way that it functions with the DNA and the ability to reproduce and all of the things that the intelligence, everything, it just
the simplest human cell puts to shame the most advanced nanotechnology of man.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. And speaking of the ooze, I mean, we've all heard of the primordial ooze, is I guess there's scum that formed along the shoreline from which the first cell appeared. Do you know where that theory first emanated, primordial ooze?
No.
I didn't either until I researched this. But his name was Oparin. He was a Soviet scientist who was a close associate of Lysenko, from which the term Lysenkoism derives. And what Lysenko and his gang used to do is, at the behest of the Soviet ruling committee in the 20s, they would bend the science in such a way to fit whatever they wanted it to fit. So, I mean, this is even acknowledged today by the left. There's even a term called Lysenkoism. It's just phony science. But what's interesting is one of Lysenko's right-hand men, this Oparin, who came up with the primordial ooze, the primordial ooze survives. So even though Lysenkoism is discredited universally and scoffed at, this part, just this one part of Lysenkoism from Soviet scientist named Oparin has survived. He is the originator of primordial ooze, which is, there's just nothing to it but his imagination.
Sure.
So.
Sure.
So even Stalin gave evolution a great leap forward by having one of his henchmen, you know, come up with this nonsense about the ooze, which nobody can define.
Sure. I think it's really funny. You have quite a sense of humor. In your book, your new book, it says that it mentions, and you can look at what is it? What do you call it? Just kind of a preview of the book, and it's called The God of Logic. And you can look at a preview, and in the preview it says, Mike King takes Chucky Darwin to the woodshed. I think that's so funny.
What? You know, when it comes to dealing with people who have a different opinion than I do, or not informed or ignorant, I always try to be respectful, because at one point all of us, to one extent or another, were there. But when you're dealing with, deliberate falsehood or willful ignorance and stupidity, then the gloves come off, and I love to scoff at these people and just pour scorn and ridicule upon them just to discredit them. You know, I can tolerate a person who's ignorant, but I cannot tolerate someone who is willfully ignorant. Meaning,
who is deceptive.
Once you show them the facts, they still persist in their error, because then they're insane. They should be laughed at.
Sure.
So, but all of my works contain, you know, that kind of biting humor. But
yes,
I always
they
make
do.
That distinction. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I did an article one time, and it was entitled "Before Marx, There Was Roosevelt." In fact, I think I may have included a lot of the information in one of my books that talks about the association between the book that Clinton Roosevelt wrote, and he wrote "The Science of Government Founded on Natural Law," and it was an effort to implement the Illuminati plan for the United States, and it really was a book that where he showed that he wanted to get rid of the gradually eliminate the U.S. Constitution, and he talked about the Rothschilds, and he talked about all of the agents, Horace Greeley and Charles Dana and those people, but Clinton Roosevelt was a distant cousin of Franklin and Theodore. And actually may have inspired FDR's New Deal, as well as, you know, the National Recovery Act and all of that, all of the things that that he used to, well, impose communism in the United States. And Roosevelt, the original Clinton, claimed that there was that there was no difference between what he was trying to do and what the communists did, and I think that Marx took a lot of Roosevelt's work, and he and Engels included it in their work.
Yeah, interesting. I learned something there. Yeah. But, I mean, Karl Marx was not the original communist. I mean, that word communist was actually already in use at least 20 years before he even put pen to paper.
Exactly.
So he was just, I mean, he was a hired hack, really. You know, he
sure.
put pen to paper.
Sure.
You know, to the ideas.
You mean he
you know, most of
stuff?
These great, you know, whenever you hear anyone described as a great thinker, you know somebody's pulling your strings.
Sure.
The truly great thinkers and economists and writers and philosophers of the last 100 years, by definition, they will be unknown.
Sure.
Yeah. That's pretty much my rule, which is like 99% accurate. Somebody who's hyped to the stars, you know, is a fraud, and somebody who's buried or either ridiculed, you know, that's one of the good guys.
Sure.
That's a general rule that you're pretty safe going by.
Sure. And my general rule for somebody that is supposed to be an expert, if they're the only ones that are saying, oh, I'm an expert this, I'm an expert that, and there's no evidence anywhere of their expertise before they actually started saying that they were experts and before they started appearing on a bunch of radio programs and being acclaimed as an expert, before that point, well, there's just no evidence. So you think, okay, he became an expert during the process of claiming that he was an expert. Does that make sense?
Well, it's like these expert witnesses that they bring out in court cases. You'll have one on each side, both of them with the, you know, diploma decorated to the hilt. And
sure.
Here they are arguing exactly opposite things. So they
sure.
evidently can't both be experts, can they?
Sure. Depends on what they read or what they're arguing.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Interesting. It just depends on which expert is the most persuasive and how stupid ignorant the jury is.
Usually, unfortunately, it comes down to rhetoric and who's more persuasive, more passionate, more articulate.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing people look at is facts. And I did a piece on George Will recently. And in the intro, I spent several paragraphs describing the concept of sophistry and how our media and academia is infested with sophists. And a sophist is someone who has all the mannerisms and the facade of a learned, deep-thinking, philosophical person, but it's all a show. They're just, they tend to be very articulate and well-spoken, very adept with words, and sometimes, you know, their mannerisms, their facial expressions convey like a depth or an intelligence, but when you begin to scratch the surface, there's nothing there. They're just good talkers. And pretty much, you know, the people in our world today who are described by the media as, you know, great thinkers or geniuses, when you look closely, they're just sophists. They talk a lot of garbage in flowery language.
Okay. In your introduction, in your free excerpt, you talk about your first incredibility, your first skepticism, when you were six, and you were at the wise age of six, in your religion class at St. Joseph's Elementary School in Newark, New Jersey. And Sister Carmela was recounting the Old Testament story about Jonah being swallowed by a whale. And so tell us about that. I think it's just kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, in the introduction to the God of Logic, I linked two experiences. You know, one at the very beginning, which was first grade, and then the other one at university. But yeah, that was an incident, and it always stuck in my memory. She was teaching about Jonah and the whale, and I simply asked her, I said, Sister, why wouldn't he, you know, die inside the whale's stomach when he drowned from all the water? And you know, I would have been happy if she just said, well, with God, all things are possible. I would have just said, oh, okay.
Sure.
But no, instead, she ridiculed me in front of the whole class, saying, oh, look at, well, Michael thinks he knows more. He knows better than God. He's smarter than God. And right on cue, the whole class is laughing at me.
Oh, gosh.
This is a mildly traumatic event. I never forgot.
But sure.
I still remember the emotion, the loathing that I had, not as much for her, but as my classmates. Like, what are you all at? You're just laughing because she gave you the cue to laugh. So I refer to that as AGR syndrome, authority, groupthink, and ridicule. She's the authority figure. So she cast the ridicule on my question, and right on cue, all the sheep laughed. So even at an early age, I knew I thought differently than
sure.
Thank
sure.
God
for that. And what about the stomach acid? I mean, all the other stuff. Well, of course, it's a simple. It's a question that should be asked.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, she wasn't equipped
to
answer it.
And you asked it.
None of the other kids asked. Yeah, no, none of the other kids would even think of such a thing. And isn't that really indicative of our world today?
Yes.
So that was an important life lesson I learned. And I've always, as long as I can remember, I've never been antisocial, but I've always been kind of against the grain. I always like looking at people like, you know, why do they, don't they think, you know? I'd always be the one to come up with a new way of thinking. I don't know. I think I attribute that to the large gap between my older siblings and myself. So I had a lot of alone time growing up. So I think I had to rely on my own ingenuity and creativity to, you know, entertain myself and play with myself. So I don't know, but I've always fought against the mob.
Sure.
But that was my first memorable experience with that phenomenon. And then in I go on in that introduction to describe something that happened at university level. Now, by this time, I had become an atheist because that's what my professors taught me. And, you know, when they begin to ridicule things like the story of Jonah and something, I thought, well, you know what, this isn't really tenable. So, and then they suck you in. You know, you're young and vulnerable. You're like, yeah, evolution. Oh, that makes sense. Okay. I wasn't like a fanatic atheist, but I did lose not only Catholic faith, but faith in a creator itself. But there was an incident that happened in university. There was an old Marxist professor I had in astronomy class called Melsky. And, he would give out these mini homework assignments and he would hand them back. And he would always encourage students to ask a question. And this was he was weird. I mean, he did homework assignments, but you didn't have to put your name on them. You weren't graded or anything. You didn't even have to do it. The only thing he graded on you was the midterm and the final. But students would often submit questions, and it could be a question on anything. It could be sports, money, politics, you name it. And he wouldn't read out all the questions, but at the beginning of each class, he would, you know, look at these papers, and he might take like two or three and addressed him. I mean, the guy was an egomaniac. He was full of himself. You know, he fancied himself an expert on every subject, whatever, from sports to money to politics to current events. But anyway, one day somebody asked a question, how does evolution account for the relationship between the eyeballs and the eye socket? They're both different elements of the body. Wouldn't they have to have come into existence at the same time? Because, you know, what good would the skeletal eye sockets if there's no eyes? And how did the skeletal system anticipate the future evolution of the eyeball, you know?
Wow.
So it's a very valid question. It made you think.
Sure.
And he went right into ridicule, just like Sister Carmela did, and starts just taking, you know, some of the stories of the Old Testament and ridiculing them, but he never really answered the question. And
avoidance. So he was using the avoidance tactic.
And then, but guess what happened as he's addressing this? Most of the class started laughing. Now, the questioner was anonymous, so, you know, he was spared the humiliation that I had to endure when I was a child.
Sure.
And it was the same thing. It was just coming from two different ends of the spectrum. And it really made an impact on me. I'm like, this guy's so smart. He's a big astronomer or physicist. Why couldn't he address that basic question? It was just a total dodge. He gave some vague answers, and he went right into ridicule. And that started bringing me back to maybe, well, I guess agnosticism, and then eventually coming back to, you know, there has to have been a designer, creative intelligence at work.
Sure.
But, so those are two, just two events in my life, both occurring in a classroom setting, one as a child and the other as an adult, and yet they were the same.
Sure. Sure. And I think, too, well, you could probably go to Times Square and see some people that looked like some of the supposed people that we have evolved from. I mean, there's all kinds of really scary looking people all over, and of course we've also heard, well, if we evolved from monkeys or something, why are there still monkeys? And, you know, just all kinds of questions that kids might ask. This was in what kind of class was this? He was a physicist, and he was teaching an astronomy. I took an astronomy class, and this guy, the first night, He literally filled all the blackboards on three sides of the room with all these equations, and this college had this. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. And the first night he opened up this what was it called? I can't remember. But we saw the stars, and it was amazing. He played this dramatic music, and oh my gosh, what a class that was. The first night of class. And then pretty soon, I mean, it started with maybe 30, 35 students. And before long, it was down to 15 because this guy was, well, he was just kind of different. Probably much the same as Professor Melsky was to you. He just, he was unconventional. I stayed with the class, but...
Yeah, I think half of them are mad, like really mad. Like,
yeah,
crazy.
I think it was. He was...
But
Go ahead.
Well, I have a quote in my book from what may be the greatest scientific genius of all time, and that's Nikola Tesla.
Oh, yeah.
The father of commercial electricity, who doesn't get anywhere near the credit that he deserves, which is just astonishing, considering
absolutely
what he accomplished.
And we don't even know exactly what all he did accomplish, since the government took all of his papers and all of his resources and all of his stuff.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they might have even knocked him off for all we know, but he died alone in a hotel room. It's just a tragic story.
Yeah.
But there's no... It's impossible to exaggerate the degree of his genius. But he wrote about these types of scientists, these theoretical scientists who like to write all these math equations and think that they prove anything. But here's Tesla writing about theoretical science. He writes, today's scientists, and this would be about 1930s and 40s, today's scientists have substituted mathematics for experiments, and they wander off through equation after equation and eventually build a structure which has no relation to reality. The scientists from Franklin to Morse were clear thinkers, and they did not produce erroneous theories. The scientists of today think deeply, but not clearly. One must be sane to think clearly, but one can think deeply and be quite insane.
Right.
And then he goes on to say, Einstein's relativity is a massive deception wrapped
in
beautiful mathematics. Yep,
absolutely.
Wrapped in beautiful mathematics. Einstein is a beggar dressed in purple clothes and made king by the use of dazzling mathematics, the truth.
Sure. He's a fraud, a total fraud.
Oh, absolutely. And Tesla, by the way, believed in God, believed in a creative intelligence force not as a result of his childhood dogma. Yes, he was raised Orthodox, but as a result of his scientific observation. And right. It was the same with Edison, the same with Ben Franklin. I mean, Isaac Newton. I mean, they're truly great giants of science. Come to that conclusion just from the orderliness, the perfection, the symmetry, that it's impossible for this not to have come about without a creative, intelligent force.
Absolutely.
So, but a lot of people don't know that. I mean, Tesla now is getting some more credit after all these years. You hear his name come up. I mean, they've even named a car after him. But very few people know that Tesla, to his dying day, repudiated Einstein and denounced him as a fraud and a long-haired crank, or at least among his private circles he did, if not publicly. No.
Sure.
But we all worship Einstein.
I don't. I think he's a fraud.
Greatest genius ever. The name is synonymous with genius. It's just incredible.
Yes, absolutely. So anyway, how's your book selling?
It's doing well. It's doing about as well as the other ones. I have a base of readership. Every time I come out with something new, they jump on it. But this one here is it's starting to penetrate into other realms. I've been doing some advertising with the Stumble Upon social network and targeting religious folks. So I'm getting some sales with it from people outside of the conventional New World Order conspiracy world. But it does tie in. It ties in perfectly. It's a key element of the New World Order.
Sure.
So, I don't dwell on that theme, but I do bring it up. So anybody who's a discerning reader is going to come to the conclusion, not only that it's a fraud, but there's a political motivation behind it. Because, you see, the controllers, Deanna, they know that if they can strip any faith in God among the public, that the next thing to go will be any sense of morality. And it's far easier to dominate a society of people without a sense of higher virtue, or degenerate people. You see, virtuous people are going to be far less tolerant of the garbage that we see in our government. That's right in our face now.
Yeah. There's some people in the chat room that are indicating that they're having a difficult time hearing you. So is there any way that you can turn your volume up?
I can try to speak louder.
Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Now, the other thing, too, is if you get rid of God, then there's a tendency for people to look to the government to take care of them rather than to God to give them the strength to take care of themselves and to be self-reliant. So, absolutely, it is easier. And when you look at the garbage on television and you think, oh, goodness, as religion in America has declined, immorality has gone up, where people will accept any kind of, you can't call it morality, any kind of behavior or language in the culture. I mean, the language is absolutely horrible. When you listen to some kids talk, oh my gosh!
Oh yeah, the young people today. I mean, when I was that age, sometimes amongst my friends, we might throw out a forbidden word, but never in the public realm, in the presence of adults. I mean, the kids today have no inhibition with that whatsoever. We are in absolute freefall now. I have a piece at the website about this transgender trend that's sweeping across America. I have documented to date about a dozen cases
American high schools in which cross-dressers, transvestites, were elected by their sympathetic classmates as either prom queen or prom king or homecoming king and queen. In some cases, it's been queen and queen. So it's happening a lot now. Now we've gone beyond the homosexual. The transsexual, the acceptance of the transvestite is the next step. And it's already here. And beyond that will come the pedophilia and the bestiality. You know, in Germany and Denmark, bestiality brothels...
Oh, I don't want to know this.
Yeah.
I already know I don't want to know anymore. My friend told me about this, and I thought, this is so disgusting. I don't want to hear about this. I love animals. I just can't think about. Well, okay. Here's another thing: the way that people treat animals also is characteristic of a society that has become so desensitized and so immoral and so inconsiderate and uncompassionate when you see people treating animals in the way that they do. If they're treating animals that way, what's the next step? You're going to treat other human beings that way. And, of course, the desensitization also, there's a group of people who will go off and kill strangers in another land just because their government says this is what we'd like you to do. They're not stopping to think, well, now why would I do that? And before, they really had to, they had a very difficult time in World War I and World War II, and of course the so-called Civil War, in trying to get people to try to get the men to go and kill others, because it is foreign to our natures to kill each other.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it really wasn't until World War II that it became acceptable to exterminate large groups of civilians and firebomb cities the way we did.
Right.
I mean, although we did not have that capacity in World War I, I don't think it would have been possible. Just in that interim phase between the two world wars, there was already a demoralization of humanity that it started to become acceptable.
Right. And
now it's a game. I mean, today, you can see a woman like Madeleine Albright asked point blank years ago on 60 Minutes if she thought the death of 500,000 Iraqi children was worth it. And she just, without batting an eyelash, said, yes, we think it was worth it. You remember that?
Yeah. Yep, I wrote about that in an article.
The metaphorical killing off of God also facilitates war. So
sure.
It's not just on the domestic front that we suffer. It makes it far easier to just kill innocent people.
Sure. Yeah. All righty, let's see. What else have you talked about recently? How's your voice doing? It sounds like you're having a little bit of trouble with your voice.
I'm a little raspy. I could use a drink, but I'm
not
at home now.
Yeah, go and get a drink. Yeah, go and get a drink. We can talk. I can talk about this situation. The other thing that Mike has written about, he wrote a piece on Hitler visits Oprah. That's kind of indicates his humor. And he has written about white guilt. I think we need to talk about white guilt. And I think that is an issue. In fact, I saw a cartoon. It was on one of Ingrid Zundel sends out an email, and she had a cartoon, and it was from the Peanuts Peanut Gallery, and this little black kid said, "I really like being black," and this white kid said, in the next frame, the white kid says, "I like being white," and then the black kid says, "Racist," and so there's a lot of feeling that somehow the whites have been, they're guilty of doing so many things, when in fact that's just not the case. I mean, yes, of course, whites have done some not so great things, but there's all the other races, there's bad people in each ethnic category, in each ethnic group.
Yeah. Well, you know, behind the anti-whiteness is the hand of the Jewish supremacist.
And yes.
Essentially, what the ultimate goal is for them to be the only Caucasian subset left in town. So once we've been knocked off, it's not going to be a world that's ruled by diversity. I assure you, the chosen ones will stay at the top. But you know, right from the beginning, when the heavy Jewish immigration started arriving in America, they wasted very little time. In 1905 or 1906, the Jewish playwright Israel Zangwill produced a Broadway play called The Melting Pot.
Right.
That's how he coined the phrase. It was a few years after that the NAACP was established, and all of its board members were Jewish.
Right.
And they put up a black front man. So, you know, this ongoing effort to multiculturalize America and to vilify white people, you know, it's not coming from the blacks and browns. They're just tools.
Right.
They're being used.
Sure.
Recently had Jacob Schiff. He was probably the most influential man of the 20th century, Jacob Schiff. But he was a board member of the NAACP.
Mm-hmm. They actually did not have a black leader until 1977, and they started in 1909, and their whole board consisted of Jewish people.
Yeah, it was Jewish organization, Jewish money,
right?
And it was a multi-year program. It was very successful because at that time, okay, the principal spokesman, leader, whatever you want to call it, of Black America was Booker T. Washington. And if you read his books, his writings, his message is the complete opposite of the NAACP and the Black Radicals. It was
right.
A message of self-reliance, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, fend for yourselves, religion, morality, and you know, get along with the white man. There's no need to be in a sense of conflict. So it was a very positive, uplifting message. And contrary to the propaganda that was said, you know, in spite of segregation and everything, blacks for many decades were making material and cultural progress in America. So that's all been derailed by groups like the NAACP. And again, this is all Jewish in its origination.
Sure. Right. And really, they were the Jewish element was here very early in the United States, and they starting in about 1840s, they were really attempting to run Congress, and use the same kinds of tactics that they currently use. They were talking about anti-Semitism back then and were writing to Congress and saying, you know, we don't want to be treated like that. They use the same kind of claims of anti-Semitism back then. And they were the ones that were promoting the multiculturalism and all of the immigration. And you had people like Emma Lazarus, who was writing the poem that "Give Us Your Poor," actually, right, because the people that had come to America before that were willing to come over here and work. They weren't poor. They came over here. They made contributions. They worked very hard. And she was saying, "Oh, just send us anybody, and we'll take care of them." And that was the message of her poem, which of course ended up at the base of the Statue of Liberty. And you mentioned the playwright, and Theodore Roosevelt just thought that that was the most wonderful play. You know, he really promoted that because that was his. He was an internationalist, as was the rest of his family, and communistic.
Yeah. Roosevelt took his marching orders from Jacob Schiff. Speaking of which, I did a recent piece, and you'll find it at the updates page on Jacob Schiff. But in the late 1990s, actually it was the final year of Grover Cleveland's presidency. He was on his way out. He had about maybe a month or two left in office. A bill had been passed, both houses of Congress, which would have required all new immigrants in America to be literate. And, you know, this was really, I mean, they didn't really say it, but what they were intending was to curtail the wave of Russian Jewish immigration, because they would never have passed the literacy test back then.
Right.
And it was Schiff and the Jewish lobby that pressured President Grover Cleveland. Now, he had nothing to lose. It was his last month in office. And he vetoed this bill. And Jewish historians regard this as really historic because, you know, even though there had been heavy immigration at that time, Alexander was also a governor of New York State prior to becoming president, just like Teddy was and just like Franklin was. But by vetoing this bill, he enabled another 20 years of heavy Jewish immigration to come in. And, you know, they brought their Marxism and their Zionism with them.
Sure.
So,
right.
This game of influencing presidents goes back, you know, to the late 19th century. It only intensified under the Roosevelts, but they were already laying the foundations in the 1860s, 70s, and 1880s.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And even during Jackson's period, when the first really big recession hit, right after his presidency in 1837, was a result of his doings, and the result of his doings was his influence that he had chosen to associate with the Rothschild Bank in London. And they became the correspondent bank for the United States under Jackson.
Well, right from the beginning, they had the very first few cancer cells. Of course, now there's no reason to even conceal these kind of affiliations. You know,
sure.
When they set up the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913, the undisputed father of the Federal Reserve, as you know, is Paul Warburg. But they didn't give him the title of chairman. They just made him director of the New York City branch of the Fed.
Sure.
So he was beneath the facade. Today, they don't even bother. I mean, the last five Fed chairmen, dating back to 1970, are all members of the tribe. it's really brazen now. It's in your face.
Sure it is. Absolutely.
Because, you know, nobody would point it out because, you know, now we've been conditioned to even talk about such things as regarded as anti-Semitism.
Sure. Sure. And of course, you were we were talking a little bit ago about the morality in this country, that as religion has decreased, the immorality has increased. And you can also point to Hollywood, because they are the perception management capital of the world, I think, because of their filmmaking. And that was a very, very early venture. They've always had control of Hollywood. Now, Mike, you're on a phone, right? You're not on Skype.
No, I'm on a phone.
Okay. Somebody in the chat room asked.
Okay. Are they still having a problem hearing me?
Okay. Somebody said you really sound like you're down in that pond.
Oh, God.
So where are you anyway? I mean, you don't need to tell us exactly where you are.
Well, no, I'm in my car. I was on the road today because in the past, hold on, let me get off the speaker here.
Okay, so you're in your car. Oh, bless your heart. And
yeah,
your voice
is
creaky.
Well, it's a little creaky because I was trying to yell more.
Yeah.
But I'm in the, in the past, I've always spoken to you this way on the cell phone. I don't think there was ever any problems before. I guess in the future, though, we should do it on Skype.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's okay. Hey, we're just happy to have you on the program.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I hope it's not too bad. I don't want to turn any of your listeners off, but
no.
I'll do the best I can. Try to speak loudly. But,
well,
apparently the connection today is not as good as in the past.
Sure. Well, the we were talking about the morality and whatnot, and when I talk to people or when I talk to my friends or family or whatnot, they always say, "Oh yeah, those people on the left. Oh gosh, they're terrible. They're just destroying America," but they never actually say it. It's like saying, "Oh yeah, it's a boogeyman," or "It's a devil," or "It's." They don't identify who the left is and who the people are who compose the left, because it's politically incorrect to do that. And I don't think that they even know, they don't look at the details of stuff.
Now, I mean, that's the way the game is structured. They break us into two camps, left and right. And, I mean, it was a philosopher once said that the purpose of the left is to destroy society, and the purpose of the right is to make sure that it doesn't get stopped.
Yeah. I think you're right.
You know, without the money and the brains and the organizational power of the Jewish supremacists, the left is nothing.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah. Well, the whole country was initially set up not to have a two-party system. I mean, there was not a two-party system defined in any government document. It just evolved that way. So that was set up. They set it up at that time. And of course, you have to look at the people, Hamilton and the people that were around at the time, who devised that.
Yeah, well, Hamilton was very opposed to the election of Thomas Jefferson as third president.
Sure.
And him and his associates, they, you know, they really solidified the party system. Their party back then was the Federalists. and I guess you could compare the Federalists back then to a modern day Democrat Party.
Sure.
They were very opposed to people like Jefferson. Now, it's interesting. I discovered that by the time that Teddy Roosevelt had left office, the Democratic Party was pretty much in shambles. I mean, the Republican Party was dominant back then. And they wanted to get rid of Taft, who would not take orders from Jacob Schiff. So a group of big money Jews got together in New York, and they revitalized the Democratic Party. And they really built it up as they began to build it up as an instrument to destroy the conservative constitutional wing of the Republican Party. You know, people like Taft and Harding and so on.
Sure.
But this comes to us from Benjamin Friedman. I'm sure you've heard of Benjamin Friedman.
Oh yes,
it happened in his father's home. He was still a young man in his 20s. But he was already a secretary to Bernard Baruch. So he tells the story of how they got together and essentially, they didn't invent the Democratic Party, but they essentially reformed it, and it made it their party in the living room of his father.
Sure.
But Friedman's work is just outstanding because, I mean, he was there. He was one of them as a very young man. And then he broke free of that. So it's just incredible, his videos, his books.
Speaking of culture also, I think it's interesting to note that when you're talking about distraction, of course, they would like to keep everybody distracted, dumbed down, that when you look at the things that distract people, you have to include football games and baseball games and all those sports things. And then you also have to bring in the entertainment field outside of Hollywood, in addition to Hollywood. So you'd have to look at the music industry.
Yes.
And look at the principles in all of those areas. And it goes back to the very first like the Belmonte race, the Belmont Stakes, that was set up by a Jew who adopted the name Belmont. And so horse racing, although it used to, I'm sure that people had horse racing, who owned horses, but they made it something that that they could make money on, and they monopolized it. And made it more professional, so that and look at the ownership of all of the sports teams.
Yeah, it is vastly disproportionate. I mean, the National Football League, there's 32 teams. They've got 10 of the owners, so that's like a third. Percentage is even higher in basketball. The commissioner of the NBA is Jewish. The commissioner of baseball, the commissioner of hockey, the commissioner of soccer. So you look at sports, you look at Hollywood, you look at music, you look at book publishing, you look at academia. I mean, they're at the top. They've got all the bases covered, to use a sports metaphor. And they've really got to be laughing at us, just laughing at the way they're able to manipulate the public in any direction that they choose to. And the political message permeates everything. Even in sports, it's heavily political. You know, you could have an athlete or a coach say the wrong thing, and he'll be suspended. You know, I mean, what does it matter what a baseball player says about the New York City subway system? I mean,
sure.
There was a player years ago named John Rocker made some derogatory comments about he would never want to play in New York, and he described what, you know, the people are like on the subways. And, you know, they ended up suspending him, and eventually his career was ruined because of this. So, you know, sports is another tool that they use for brainwashing.
Sure. Or for just distracting people.
Well, that's the main reason. That's the main thing because, you know, you get people addicted to sports, and they will watch 15 to 20 hours of ball games a week. Now, if you just took a fraction of that time, okay, imagine what you could learn about how the world works. I mean, people sometimes think I'm immersed completely in study, and I'm not. I'm probably about an hour and a half, 2 hours a day. And I pretty much know the history of the 20th and 19th centuries like the back of my hand. I know economics. I know what's going on in the world. Only an hour and a half a day. A fraction of the time that people spend watching ball games. So imagine if people just took a fraction of their entertainment time and put it into studying the things that matter.
Sure.
You know, we could heal this world overnight.
The other thing, too, that I've noticed that I've written about in one of my books is the militarization of sports. And it isn't just a matter of, well, for instance, in team sports, you have the uniforms, you have the music, you have the camaraderie. That, in fact, if you look at Pat Tillman, who was just gung ho, he was going to go to the Middle East, and then after he got there, he figured out what was going on, and he would have come back, according to his family, he would have come back and would have enlightened people as to what was actually going on, and so they had to eliminate him permanently in order to keep him from doing that, because other people, sports enthusiasts, would have embraced what he said.
No doubt. I mean, he was a big threat because they had turned him into a hero.
Right.
Now when he comes back, they wouldn't be able to just turn that off. I mean, he was already a football star, and then they made a demigod out of him. So that would have been a big problem if he came back and he got wise to how the world works. And
right.
That's exactly why they got rid of Patton, because Patton was built up into a hero. And then he figured out that World War II was a fraud, and they didn't want to deal with him, you know, coming back.
Sure.
So there's no question, because at a time when U.S. casualties in Afghanistan were minimal, what are the odds that him, of all people, should be killed? And then, of course, you look at the circumstances of his death. But,
sure.
But his status as a sports hero, it's sort of like the movie Gladiator. I don't know if you've ever seen Gladiator with Russell Crowe. But once he was built up into such a hero, as a great gladiator, he became a threat to the emperor. So... You know,
yes.
Maybe that's what it's going to take. Maybe we need somebody to come out of the sports or entertainment world and wake up and lead us. Because that, evidently, that's all that people will follow.
Sure. That has been a really big distraction, and it's really unfortunate. And the other thing is, it has made it easier, I believe, for people to accept, now this is going to sound a little bit racist here, it has been easier for people to accept multiculturalism because a lot of the sports figures make a lot of money, and probably if they were some kid on the street or just a regular person, maybe they would not be able to attract, oh gosh, this is going to sound so racist. They wouldn't be able to attract some of the white women that they attract.
Yeah. Well, that is a big part of the program. I mean, you see the show, the Kardashian sisters, these horrible harlots, glorified in the media, and they've all had multiple black boyfriends. And if a black and a white meet and fall in love, I mean, okay, that's their business. But what I have a problem with is the deliberate pushing of it, the promotion of it in the media, and what the real motive is. It's not about tolerance and getting along with other people. No, let's be frank. They are aiming to exterminate the white race through attrition, through immigration, through low birth rates among whites, through intermarriage. So, you know, it's not what it seems on the surface. It's not about different people tolerating each other and getting along. And, you know, that's all wonderful. There's something nefarious going on here.
Sure.
And if you do the numbers, you look at the statistics, you take the birth rates, the immigration rates, the rate of interracial relationships now, and you project this out 10, 20, 30, 40 years, okay, we end up like white South Africans.
Right.
We're going to suffer the
sure.
same fate.
And sure.
I don't see why the European peoples should not be permitted to have a sense of identity as to their people and culture when it's permitted to every other race on the planet.
Sure, sure. For instance, you are never going to see, they do have a magazine. I believe it was called Ebony. They might still have a magazine. What if we had a magazine called Ivory? We would get all kinds of criticism, just as that cartoon that I mentioned a few minutes ago. I didn't know the Kardashians had a program. I knew that they were very popular, but I don't know why they're popular. Who made them popular? What did they do that has made them have a program on TV?
If the masters of the Hollywood decree that someone is popular, well, that's enough to make them popular, you see.
Yeah, but
Kim Kardashian's great accomplishment was being the daughter of one of the lawyers for O.J. Simpson.
Right.
And then also releasing a homemade pornographic video via YouTube. So that's how she gained the name that she has.
Oh, gosh.
You know, so it's quite an achievement, isn't it?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Sure.
Yeah.
That's terrific.
No, that's our society. Meanwhile, you know, great men of science, true science, and inventors and artists, they toil in obscurity. But the Kardashians achieve fame and fortune beyond anyone's dream.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. And I think that's part of the sports and entertainment world. But particularly I see it in the sports world. Although I don't pay attention to the sports world, that's, you know, just what limited exposure I have. And
right.
I think, gosh, what's the deal here? And,
two of her husbands were black athletes.
Right. And then, of course,
the third one is a so-called rapper.
And then, of course, teenagers, young people, they look to sports figures as the heroines, the heroes. And so they're going to want to do what their heroes do. The people, probably the people back in the 30s and the people in the 40s, their idea of a hero was totally different than people's ideas of heroes are today. My heroes when I was growing up was my favorite teachers that I really, really respected, or various writers that I read. I looked to them for wisdom and knowledge, and now kids aren't looking for wisdom and knowledge. I mean, you obviously as a sixth grader, and when you were in school, you were looking for wisdom and knowledge. And now, I think the caliber of people that one denotes as a hero is, well, it's pretty bad. Well, look at the way that kids dress.
I mean, look at the way that adults dress. I mean, you go to these spectacles, these modern-day gladiator games, and, there's nothing wrong with watching an occasional ball game. I still will from time to time. But, you know, when you go to every game and you're an adult and you're wearing the uniform of one of the thug players on the field and cheering so passionately as if your life depends on it, that to me is a mental disease. But it's afflicted millions of people. It's obsessed with this sports business. I mean, there's even radio and TV stations which talk sports 24 hours a day, and they're quite popular. But you talk to some of these people about the looming world wars that we're heading towards, or the looming economic collapse, or things like that, and they're not even interested. It bores them. And it's amusing to me, because apart from the things that we discuss being so important, it really is riveting drama. If you think about it, Deanna, I mean, can you get anything more suspenseful than the world events as they actually are? So if entertainment is your bag, you ought to follow the world events just for that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I do a lot of research and study, and I'm thinking, how can people believe some of the stuff that they believe in when it doesn't make sense? Just because authority figures tell you. You challenged your teacher. You were a six-year-old kid, and you challenged your teacher. Do students do that now, ever? Do they challenge their teachers ever? Do we challenge our doctors? Do we challenge anybody in authority? It seems that we have all been brainwashed into thinking that we're all obedience trained. We're like, I used to take my dog to obedience training, and I think we have all been obedience trained by the entertainment that we watch, by the things that we worship, the abandonment of the values that we grew up with, and now we have displaced those values, because people have to have something to believe in. Just because somebody no longer believes in God does not mean that they're not going to transfer or replace that belief in something else, because we all want to believe in something.
Yes, yes. And, you know, it's interesting. These liberals always fancy themselves as anti-establishment or nonconformist, but in reality, they've always been the most conforming bunch of sheep. You look at the hippies. You know, they grew their hair long as a rebellion against conformity of society. But in reality, they were just conforming to their peers. They just transferred that sense of belonging and that obedience from one master to another. So, in a sense, we really are biologically programmed to worship authority. And,
right.
And logically, that should lead you to God. But when it doesn't, it's going to lead you somewhere else, to somebody else's authority.
Sure. Well, look at the destruction of the family. And that, I think, has been rather gradual. I think that, and it gets back to extracurricular activities. I know families who literally they pick up their kids from school. They take them to this game or that game or to soccer practice or piano practice, And the school is having more influence over the family because the school is running, managing a lot of those activities. And the what used to be things that they talked about in the family. I mean, who ever heard of having learning about sex or learning about the things that you normally learned at home? All of a sudden, you're learning things at school that the school has no business teaching.
Yeah, I understand in Chicago they're rolling out sex education for kindergartners. They call it age-appropriate sex education for kindergartners. So, you know, it's just a total breakdown of everything. And, you know, the end result is just a society of alienated people who really have no roots in anything. I read just the other day that for the first time ever, a majority of Americans live alone. And,
wow.
You know, it's because of the divorce. It's also because our young people today don't even get married. Many of them don't even have relationships. It's like right out of Orwell's 1984.
Sure.
So when you break down those social bonds, you know, there's no one left to look after you if you need help but the government.
Sure. Oh,
it's really diabolical. Yeah.
We have a caller. I just noted. I'm sorry. Okay, let's take a call here. Let me just bring them up here. Caller 304.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, I didn't look at the screen.
Yeah. Hi, Deanna. This is Ken from West Virginia.
I thought that was your number.
Yeah. A couple of things. About the conformity. I'm somebody who grew up. I can remember one of my very first memories is trying to be forced to wear blue jeans, and I remember refusing to wear them because they were totally uncomfortable. And now we've become conditioned to not put on our trousers or our pants. We put on our jeans, and you know, when I was a teenager in high school, and I would scoff at all these. I lived down around Washington. All these very posh clubs in Georgetown. They wouldn't let anybody wear blue jeans, and you had all these yuppie types who definitely could afford to. You know, jeans are great for somebody if you're working, you know, for a working man, but there's no way a nice pair of cotton trousers are less comfortable than a pair of jeans. But they would demand to get into these places wearing their blue jeans, and you'll see these movie stars on television, American 20 Million, and they show up wearing sneakers and blue jeans. And I'm wondering, who are they? You know, we used to see the communists in China wearing their Mao suits and scoff at them, but it's the same thing in this country. And I occasionally going into a bar down here where I'm at, and I would look in and say, well, I'm the only one in here not wearing jeans, just wearing trousers and a button-down shirt. And there's a few people around here I know that we often talk about it. And one guy says, the only thing that you wear that by the time they're comfortable, they're worn out, you know. But there's a conditioning thing going on, you know. And then I remember one time I did run down around Washington and would take a bus ride to Baltimore to see an Orioles game, you know, and from a pub and everything. And we would pass on the way a brewery for National Bow, Bohemian Beer, and Schaefer's Beer. And then you get into the stadium, and they're hawking Budweiser, National Bow, and Schaefer's. And the Budweiser at the time was $2.50, and the other, you know, the ones that was brewed right there in Baltimore was $1.75. And I would shout out, hey, National Bow up here, you know, and all these people on the bus would say, what are you drinking that for? Because that's what the advertising. Advertising dictates everything, you know. So that's there's a couple of examples of, you know, the most programmed people in the world, I think, in this country.
Indeed. Your thoughts, Mike?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, this goes back to Edward Bernays, who openly wrote about this, about the power to manipulate the public's, not just their political opinions, but their tastes and their mores. So this is very scientific. It's no different. I mean, if you wanted to take your dog to an academy, okay, they're going to train that dog using the same techniques that they train the public. And the public is not aware of it. But they can, you know, given enough time, because at our core, we are animals. We just have more advanced intellects. But in terms of our impulses and instincts, we are animals. And they play on that. So it's a shame. I mean, and it's not necessarily a bad thing that humans are endowed with this herd mentality. Because if the leaders of society are wise and just, they can harness that to a positive end. So it's not really good or bad. It's just now the people calling the shots are able to use that herd impulse and drive us off the end of a cliff.
Well, yeah, just the whole idea of advertising is people will go out and they'll take the drug of choice that they heard about on some advertisement, even though the advertisement says, well, it might cause heart problems, it might cause emphysema, it might cause suicide, it might cause this, it might cause that. But they'll run to the doctor and say, "Oh, I heard about this. Could you please write me a prescription about it?" Just because they heard about it on TV. Now, that's crazy.
Yeah. You know, I've always, again, going back to my childhood, you know, whenever I would hear an advertisement on television that said 4 out of 5 doctors recommend or 4 out of 5 dentists recommend, the first thing that comes to my mind instinctively is, why is that other guy holding out? He must know something.
Of course. Kent, did you have some other comments to make?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. He had an experience in school. I remember when I was going to high school, you know, that was when Psychology Today was real popular, and I didn't know anything. So it was an elective, and I took the psychology course, and there was this Jewish guy, I forget his name, but he had the beard and the goatee. I mean, he just looked like one of the Peter, Paul, and Mary, what the dude with Peter Yarrow, I think, or whatever, the one who had the beard and the goatee. And he was going on about the everything was a phallic symbol and this sort of thing. And I thought, well, about the tie and the gear shift in the car. Well, I thought that, first of all, Ted Williams was the ultimate man's man in the United States, would not wear a tie. And then I was followed the Formula One racing, you know, and I thought, well, Ferrari came out with a push-button gearbox that didn't have a gear shifter, and Enzo Ferrari was the ultimate. And I thought, well, there's their whole the stupid garbage just gone down the drain. But I wanted to ask, you were talking about publishing a book on Amazon or something. You can just prepare a PDF and they'll do all the you submit it to them and they'll just take care of it. Do we have any links on that or anything?
Look up Create Space. It's a division of Amazon, and it's fairly user friendly, but all it involves is you submitting your completed book the way you want it. You could do it as a Word doc or PDF, and then they'll format it, for you. And then, as far as the cover, you're probably going to want to. Their covers for their free books are so basic, and they limit you so much as far as a design. I don't know if you want to use that, but if you want something according to your specifications, as far as an image, you know, that's $400, and, you know, they'll work for you. There's a form you can fill out. A consultant will call you. So, they work with you throughout the process, and then they send you a proof. So it was a very easy process. Very, very simple. The only thing to be aware of is, you know, they advertise that it's free, which it is. But I don't think you're going to want to use their cover service. You're probably going to want them to do an image according to your description, in which case it's $400.
Right. But I guess you could supply your own image. Go ahead.
Don't they charge you for editorial services and formatting?
Well, if you want them to do the proofreading, there's an extra charge for that.
Okay.
But, you know, if you've got your thing ready to go and all you want is the interior and the cover, you know, that's it. You don't need to pay for the other stuff.
And do they get the ISBN number for you?
They take care of the ISBN. They take care of putting you on Amazon. And that's it. And then, you know, the rest is up to you, I guess, to promote it. And then they will sell you, the author, they will sell you copies for a song, you know, very, very inexpensively, depending on how many pages there are. But it's far, far cheaper than if you were to make copies at a local copy center. So, yeah, I would recommend it. Create Space, it's called.
Create Space. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Okay,
my
thanks,
pleasure.
Ken.
Okay.
All righty. Okay, if anybody has questions or comments about some of the things that we've discussed today, do feel free to call in. And, of course, that telephone number to call in and ask a question is... What number is it? What number is it?
Is it the number I
called? Hang
on.
Yes, the number you called.
646-787-1915.
Okay, that's the number to call in. I had the wrong document in front of me here. Yes, that is the number to call into if you have questions or if you want to email a question or comment. Of course, that number, address is comment@spingola.com, or you can ask a question in the chat room, and the chat room is spingola.chatango.com. I just really like chat rooms. I think they're terrific, and because you can kind of keep track. People can ask questions, and it's just good thing to have. I'm glad I followed the recommendation and got one. Now, do you have a Twitter? Do you tell us about how people can contact you and tell people how they can access
if you go to
your
the
stuff?
Website, yeah, if you go to tomatobubble.com, there's links to follow me on Twitter as well as Facebook. And there's also a free report that people can sign up for. It will enable you to get my free updates, which I send out 2 to 3 times per week. So you'll see that right on the front page. The free report is called How to Respond to an Anti-Conspiracy Theorist, and that signs you up for the free newsletter. About 80 to 90% of the content is free, but definitely people might want to have a look at the samples of some of the pay-per-view PDFs and books as well. But there's a lot to keep you busy there. There's a section called Archived Classics, which is all my best pieces from the last 3 years, and they're all categorized. There's a page on World War II. There's a page on the culture wars. There's a page on economics. There's a page on the war on whites, and so on. So it's very user-friendly. Lots of information there, heavily illustrated, and the common theme throughout every piece is the simplicity. You know, it's really designed for people to get the essence of the subject in a very clear, concise, and quick manner.
Okay. The Archive Classics. All righty, let's... And that's wonderful. You have all of these files. I like the way that you have all these files set up.
Yeah, and I just did that a couple of weeks ago. I had so much stuff on the site, I wanted to get some sort of organization.
Yeah,
I'm
like that.
I'm still not done with the process, but, you know.
You could spend a great deal of time just fixing up a website and getting it user-friendly, but I think that you've done a really good job here of doing that because you have it... Well organized. You have all these little files. That's really nice. That is really, really good.
It's all Mike King originals.
Good. All righty. The Obongo files. Tell us what's in the Obongo files. And there's been a lot of stuff written lately about Michelle or Michael.
Yeah, isn't that something? And the untimely death of Joan Rivers.
Yeah. Of course, she was 81.
But it was a very routine procedure. She was definitely up for it. I mean, who knows? It was just very, very odd that someone should die having the procedure that she had. For her voice box, which perhaps I should get one, right?
I was just going to mention that.
But
funny you should mention that, Mike.
If you saw her in her, but I'm not going to that doctor.
No, don't go there.
But you can tell in that video where she's claiming that Michelle is a transvestite. You know, her voice was very raspy. But what struck me about that was, you know, she was not saying it in comedy in any way.
No, she was quite serious.
She was not saying it with any animosity. It was just a matter of fact. Oh, come on, we all know.
Sure.
And by we, she doesn't mean you, of course. She means her circle.
Right.
So, but that was really, really an explosive allegation. And you couple that with all of the other circumstantial stuff. And, you know, I don't know if I have to assign a percentage to it. I have to go with, I'm about 70% certain, which leaves a lot of wiggle room, of course, but I would have to say 70% that Michelle is Michael.
Well, he did call him her that at one point.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty interesting thing to forget your spouse's name.
There's no
or
photos
to remember
of
it
her
properly.
Or him. There's no photos of her or him with the children as infants. And there is an attorney out there in California made an allegation that the children were adopted from Morocco. And indeed, if you look at the daughters, they do have that North African look to them, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Almost like a darker-skinned Arabic. So it's
sure.
There's a lot of interesting circumstantial bits of evidence. When you put them all together, it certainly makes you go, anything is possible in this world, you know?
Sure. Well, given his history, or lack thereof, as far as his associations in college or his associations elsewhere, his associations within the church that he belonged to, that he was going to, that he was attending, and the fact that some of those people all of a sudden died, and the other association that he had with that guy, Larry Sinclair? Yeah, Larry Sinclair.
Right. And don't forget Reggie.
Reggie, I don't...
Oh, Reggie Love.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh, well, Google him. He was his official title was Obama's body man. That's his official title. And he basically followed Obama on all the trips, and he carried a little baggie with toothpaste and toothbrushes and things like that. But he was an ex-football and basketball star at Duke University. But he's never had a girlfriend. His mannerisms are quite effeminate, but he's generally regarded as Obama's boy toy for the last 5 or 6 years. And he stepped down just before the re-election. But him and Reggie Love were quite an item.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I have looked at various pictures over time. I remember when Michelle Obama was on the cover of, I think it was Vanity. She looked very, very feminine. Her fingers were long and fine and very feminine. And at other times, pictures look very, well, not feminine at all.
Yeah, well, so, these get totally alter images on these magazine covers.
Sure.
It's amazing what they do with these computer programs. You know, they can shrink a person's thighs. They can remove every nipple.
Right.
They can soften up their jawbones, their cheekbones. Really high tech stuff.
Yes.
You know.
Well, I'm looking at the photos.
You're right. There are some photos where she looks like something out of, you know, what was that old Broadway play, The Kaja Falls.
Yeah.
Straight up tranny.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, we've seen the photos of her looking at somebody that's talking with her spouse, where she looks like she's going to jump out of her seat and claw this person to death. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. It's just strange. One picture that you have of her on the front of Time magazine looks like Michelle. And then if you scroll up, there's that picture of her in the red dress and picture of her with the in China. That's she's pretty tall and pretty. I mean, I don't know. Just weird. Just weird.
Yeah, she's a big woman. Yeah,
she's
a big woman.
These
things will come out one day. I mean, we now know that Eleanor Roosevelt was a lesbian. That's not even contested, you know.
Sure.
By the time it comes out, people won't even care. Oh yeah.
Hillary Clinton. Yeah. Well, if the rest of society, if a lot of people in society are adopting these kinds of mores and values, what could you expect that maybe it would hit with the elite, what people would consider
society? That's how it happened in Rome. I mean, how many of their emperors were homosexual, bisexual? There was one emperor, Elagabalus, was a transvestite. He used to love dressing up in women's clothes. So, you know, there's nothing new here. This is the nature of man. Once he goes down that road, you know, it's a long, long fall, and we're not completely there yet. But keep in mind that these high school kids who elected all of these transvestite prom queens and homecoming queens, that's the voter of tomorrow. So in due time, I could definitely see a situation where an open homosexual or even a transvestite might gain the sympathy of these very same kids who are now voting for transvestite homecoming queens.
Sure.
There's one high school in California. They did away with homecoming king and queen altogether, and they just have they call it now the royal court, because they don't want to discriminate against transvestite. And they elect three people as the royal court for their homecoming football game. So the concept of a king and queen is discriminatory now against transgender.
Oh, my
gosh. That's the madness we've come to. And this is the students themselves who are doing this.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, let me share a couple of comments from the chat room. Let's see. Somebody said, I think it was Art from Philly who said on Deanna's program, and I quote, "Never has there been a U.S. president whom the people know so little about." Another comment, Michelle Michaels' face and physique has the first impression of being masculine, same as the tennis sisters. I agree with that. Yeah. Another one. Probably was behind her taking her hormone pills. I don't know about that. I don't know anything about, but And somebody else said, cover photos are always brushed. I'm sure that's true. Somebody else said, Obama is definitely more feminine with a slight build next to her. And her is in quotation marks. Somebody else said, this is kind of funny, Eleanor Roosevelt was so ugly she had no choice but to be a dyke. No self-respect. This is funny. No self-respecting male. I don't know what I can read this. No self-respecting male would have sex with something that ugly. I'm sorry.
Hey, this is a family show.
I'm sorry for all those people who like Eleanor. But when she got older, I think when she was younger, it wasn't quite so bad. But she really got pretty ugly.
Yeah, inside and out.
That is so terrible of me to say that. People should not judge people by the way they look. But.
No, they shouldn't. But I have to find it. I think there's an old speech where Hitler was talking about Roosevelt, and he says when Roosevelt was not, slandering Germany, his lovely wife Eleanor took up the effort, and the whole Reichstag burst out. The whole Reichstag burst out laughing. There's an audio of it. And he says, his lovely wife says she will not live in a world such as ours. And he said, that is understandable because ours is a world of work and not racketeering.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
He came up with some good zingers. I tell you, I could see why people could listen to him speak.
Oh, he was mesmerizing. And people loved him. And and of course, they always show him, passionate speeches, but you never know what he's saying unless you can speak German.
Well, that's right. You know what's amazing, Deanna? I mean, if you just take the actual speech and read the text and forget about all the theatrics, and I mean, even Michael Jackson said he regarded him as one of the greatest showmen of all time. I mean, he definitely knew how to captivate and work the emotions. But if you just read the text in itself, It's all logical, it's clear, it's concise, it's good, rational, logical thinking, it has a theme, a beginning, a middle, you know? If it was an essay and you had to give it a grade, it would be like A. So
exactly.
He spoke with great flair, but it was not demagoguery. There was heavy substance to it. He just knew how to deliver it in a way that, you know, everybody could grasp it and be moved.
Sure.
It was not empty rhetoric at all.
Oh, I've read a lot of his work, and there's nothing that I've read that I would disagree with as far as principles, and obviously had quite a sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, some of the stuff he said on Churchill.
Oh, indeed.
Churchill. Because, you know, it was commonly known that Churchill liked to hit the bottle.
Oh,
but Hitler
had
some really
drunk.
Good lines on that. God.
He was an absolute drunk, and people think of him as some kind of wonderful statesman. I mean, he was a drunk.
He was a warmongering drunk who totally sold his soul.
Absolutely.
Interestingly enough, it was... In the 20s, he actually wrote an article about the Jewish International Communist conspiracy.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah. So somewhere along the line, he sold his soul.
He sold out. Yeah, he sold out.
He took heavy losses in the stock market.
Sure.
He spent money prolifically. So, you know, it's very easy to get to a guy like that.
Sure. Hey, Mike, we've run out of time. Excuse me, we've run out of time. I certainly appreciate you being on the program today, and we've got to do this again. And you stay away from whoever did her surgery, because we don't want you getting getting eliminated. But thank you so much for being on the program today. And
I actually have my own food tasters.
Good. That's wonderful. Well, I hope you'll join me again. Thank you so much.
I will. Next time I'll be by Skype. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. It was wonderful. Bye-bye. It starts with you and me.